From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Southern literature is distinctive for sure, but is it inclusive?
For me, as a Black Southerner, I often feel that I'm not invited to the Southern party, that Southern has been branded as white and usually rural, and I'm a Black person from a big city of Atlanta.
That's Tayari Jones. She was recently inducted into the Georgia Authors Hall of Fame. Ahead this hour, we will talk with her and two other great Southern writers about the genre of Southern literature and whether it really is one thing. But first, we have been collecting your thoughts about what to do with Georgia's many Confederate monuments. Here are your first thoughts.
My opinion is that these monuments need to stay just where they are. They're a part of history.
My response to anyone who had that point of view is to simply say, let us also add images or statues of Blacks being hanging from trees, being lynched.
I don't think we should be promoting violent groups that tried to overthrow the government.
That was Paul Hayes from Decatur, Hugh from Gwinnett County, and Cecilia Brown from Brooks. And now it is your turn. Next Tuesday, we will devote a special hour to what Confederate symbols mean today. We will travel the entire state from Rome to South Georgia's wiregrass country with stops in Decatur, Athens, and Augusta. And we would like to include your voice. Tell us a story about a Confederate monument in your town. Do you think calls to take them down are justified? Do you want them to stay put? Or maybe, do you have an idea for a compromise? Imagine that. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Atlanta gets national attention for its cash bail system and would just as soon not. Earlier this month, a man with a history of mental illness was released from jail after 3 months of being held without trial just because he couldn't pay his $500 bail. Since then, the Atlanta mayor's office and the municipal court have proposed eliminating cash bonds for minor offenses, or rather those accused of minor offenses. Other cities across the state, like Calhoun, are seeing similar calls to action. What does bail reform look like in places where it's been tried, and what might it look like in Georgia? Joining me now is Marissa Dodson, Public Policy Director at the Southern Center for Human Rights. Good morning, Marissa.
Good morning, Adam.
Also with us is Jennifer Saliti from the Office of the Public Defender in New Jersey. New Jersey does some things very differently, and we'll find out from Jennifer momentarily. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
Marissa, remind us, what's the point of bail, making somebody pay some money when they get arrested for something? It's not a punishment like a fine, right?
That's right. That's right. The purpose of bail, there are two purposes. The first is to ensure that the person will come back to court and that they will actually deal with the charges for which they have been accused. And the second purpose is that they, you know, will not pose a public safety risk. It is to ensure that there will be no future criminal activity.
How is the latter goal theoretically achieved?
Well, that's the problem with money and the use of money, because neither one of those purposes are actually fulfilled. And so the question becomes, when you have wealth-based attention, when the condition is money, then how are either of those purposes for which bail is intended furthered?
And the consequence, of course, is that you might have a situation where a person who has no money with which to pay bail, even if it's a very modest bail by other people's standards, they could just sit in prison, jail for a very long time without having been convicted of a crime.
That's exactly right. And someone who has the money, right, say someone who does have the $500 or the $200 or whatever it is, that individual who may not come back, who has resources to actually run and flee the jurisdiction, or who may pose some kind of risk around public safety, those issues are not taken into account for that individual. And so that is why you see the large numbers of people who are incarcerated pre-trial be people who unfortunately cannot afford their release.
So what is notable to you about the cash bail system as it currently works in Atlanta and more broadly across Georgia?
Well, as I said, I think that, you know, wealth-based detention, this issue is not only is it unconstitutional in that whether or not you're incarcerated turns on your financial means, but also it perpetuates, you know, systemic poverty. This, you know, cycling individuals like Mr. McCrary, as you referenced earlier, through our criminal justice system, when these are the individuals who are most in need of services, perpetuates the same kind of systemic issues that we should be intentional on trying to address in our communities instead of using our criminal justice system as the place in which people reside.
So Atlanta's new mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, has already proposed a plan to eliminate cash bail in Atlanta. This is an issue that is close to her. Here she is explaining why in a campaign video.
I learned very early on that good people sometimes make bad decisions. Came home from school and there were police officers all over our house. And I saw my dad being led away in handcuffs. I spent every weekend visiting my dad in prisons across the state.
So, Marissa, what does the mayor have in mind for how specifically to change the bail and bonding system in Atlanta?
Well, we are encouraged by conversations we're having with the mayor and her staff. We are very optimistic that she has taken the stance that she's taken around eliminating cash bail for most minor offenses in the city. We are in conversations with her office and with city council members to try to figure out the best language to really get what we want accomplished, which again is to eliminate the use of money as a condition for most minor offenses. And I think it's important to just reiterate that what we are looking for is a mandate on this issue, that there will be clarity for individuals that if they are charged with certain offenses, that there will be no condition related to their financial obligation. And I think it's also important to just say that, you know, there are other types of conditions. You know, we need to get out of the issue or thinking that this is just about money. There are other ways in which we can use to deal with this issue.
And on that note, let's go ahead and turn to Jennifer Saliti from the Office of the Public Defender in New Jersey. New Jersey has gotten a lot of attention for reforming its pretrial system. What exactly have y'all done up there, Jennifer?
Well, what we did was enact a system that addresses both of the goals that Marissa articulated, to ensure that people appear for court and to ensure as best that we can that they don't commit a new offense while on release. So what we did was first enact a statutory scheme that created a pretrial services department to make recommendations to judges about who should be released pretrial and what sort of conditions that they need so that they're monitored by the court to make sure they show up for court dates, to get treatment, to get services that they may need while on release. Secondly, our voters approved a constitutional amendment that allowed for pretrial detention, which at first sounds strange that that would be something that we would be advocating, but we have to recognize that there are some, a very small portion of our pretrial population, some people that are too dangerous to be released. So we created a system where after a hearing in front of a judge, those people who are deemed to be too dangerous remain incarcerated up until their trial date, but the vast majority of people are released on conditions and monitored by the court to make sure that they show up for court and they don't commit new offenses.
What criteria would a court use to determine if someone is too dangerous to be released pre-trial? Would that be purely based on the seriousness of the offense, the particular offense to which they stand accused? Or could the court factor in other things that they might know about that person?
Well, we use something called the public safety assessment, which is a risk assessment tool that takes into consideration things like the age of at the current arrest, any violent convictions the person may have had, any charges pending at the time of the arrest, prior failures to appear. Have there been other times where this person hasn't shown up in court? And it gives the court a risk assessment score that they can use as a starting point. And that score is based on thousands and thousands of cases that were studied both nationally and in New Jersey. So the risk assessment tool is sort of a statistical analysis that we can use and give judges a starting point to decide whether or not this person presents a risk to public safety or a flight risk.
We're talking about reforming the bail system. course, people accused of crimes often asked to pay or made to pay money in order to get out of jail as they await trial. And often folks are not able to pay what they have been ordered to pay, and thus they end up sitting in jail for a very long time without having been convicted of a crime. And that's an issue in Georgia and in Atlanta in particular. We're talking about it with folks from the South and also with a person from New Jersey right now, whose name I'm going to pull up momentarily. So sorry. Jennifer Saletti from the Office of the Public Defender in New Jersey, talking about how they have attempted some reforms in this area in New Jersey, and not everyone in New Jersey is convinced that this is working. There's some skepticism in the law enforcement community about whether making it easier for folks to get out of jail pre-trial might enable offenders to repeat. Here is New Jersey Police Chief Joseph Walker talking to PBS NewsHour's Megan Thompson.
It's a shame that we waste time arresting people over and over again, and they keep on releasing them. I mean, our officers feel like it's a slap in the face because they're working hard to do a good case, whether it be drugs or car burglaries or whatever. They get down there and they get released, and they're out probably doing it again.
Jennifer, is that a concern that has been borne out by your experience in New Jersey, having passed these reforms?
It is not. There has been a lot of sort of fear-mongering by some of the local law enforcement and the bail industry about our new system. But what you have to remember is that prior to pretrial justice reform, people would bail out and commit new offenses. So the idea that somebody getting out and committing a new offense is the fault of the pretrial justice system is wrong, and I think it's dangerous to present information to the public that way. The truth is that you can never have a system that's foolproof. But what people have to remember is under our old system, the judge was not allowed to consider whether or not somebody was a danger to the community when the judge made the decision on whether or not to release them. Huh. And people who were released were not monitored in any way whatsoever by the court. So now we have a system that considers dangerousness, allows us to incarcerate pretrial those people who are the most dangerous, and if people are released, they have support and services and monitoring in place to prevent them from reoffending. So while it'll never be Minority Report, right, we can't predict with certainty whether or not somebody's going to commit a new crime. Sure. The tools that we have in place right now are far more superior to the ones we had in place before. And it acknowledges the fact of what Marissa was saying earlier. There has not been any study that shows that the amount of money that somebody posts has anything to do with whether or not they'll return to court or will they commit a new offense. That's
Marissa
just not
Dodson
the right way
to
go about it.
Indeed. Marissa Dodson with the Southern Center for Human Rights. In the last minute that we have, what do you hear when you hear about these reforms in New Jersey? Are these things that could be applied successfully in Georgia, in your opinion?
Absolutely. I just want to make a really quick point that we are focused in the city of Atlanta. There are some state reforms, conversations about bail around misdemeanors as well, but we are talking about low-level offenses. In Georgia, there's a constitutional right to bail in misdemeanor cases, and this notion around carving out particular crimes or offenses for which would pose the kind of public safety risk that we are concerned about, family violence battery and domestic violence situations and DUIs, those offenses would be treated differently. They would be required to go before a judge within 24 hours. We recognize that there are some legitimate public safety concerns, and we believe that we can build a system that does not focus or eliminates the use of money, but really addresses those two purposes of bail. And I think that jurisdictions like New Jersey and cities like New Orleans and Chicago are leading the way when you think about the way bail reform should happen.
It's Marissa Dodson, Public Policy Director at the Southern Center for Human Rights. We were also joined by Jennifer Saletti from the Office of the Public Defender in New Jersey. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, pull up a chair and enjoy a perfect cup of Joe as we visit Atlanta's Cat Cafe. It's on Second Thought. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in today for Celeste Headley. My next guest is the seventh generation of her family to grow up in the United States, and yet she has still been asked over and over,
"Where are you from?"
"Here."
"No, where are you from?"
Julie Lithcott-Hames responds to that question eloquently in her new memoir, Real American. It tells the story of being biracial in a society where people are exceedingly quick to classify and label by ethnicity. Julie is in Atlanta for a book signing at the Margaret Mitchell House tonight, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show, Julie Lithcott-Hames.
Adam, thank you for having me.
People, even though they might not realize it, a lot of people listening probably know you because they know you for a book that you wrote before called How to Raise an Adult. You used to be an administrator at Stanford University in charge of the freshmen, and you wrote this book, How to Raise an Adult, sort of an argument against helicopter parenting, and it became a big sensation. And I my first question to you is, is there a link between that project and this new project that you've done, this memoir, in thinking about other people's experience of growing up? Did that lead you to want to think more about your own experience of growing up?
Yes and no. I went back to school to get an MFA in writing to try to write that book that became How to Raise an Adult. I knew I wanted to write about the harm of helicopter parenting, but I knew I needed help in developing my craft. So I went off to school to try to pursue that project, landed a book deal. When I wasn't writing that book, though, Adam, when I was in classes, poetry classes, playwriting classes, creative nonfiction classes, when I wasn't focused on the harm of overparenting in that project, what kept coming up and out of me was race. And so it became a topic that was so trying to grab my attention, I decided to do something with it. And ultimately, that became my master's thesis, this memoir on race that ultimately became the book Real American.
Tell me about the title, Real American.
Well,
that's
leading,
a phrase that has entered the public discourse in many ways in recent years.
Absolutely, and I loved your intro to this interview. Many years ago, politicians on the right started using that term, Real Americans, to describe a segment of Americans that they felt their message was applicable to. And every time I heard that, Real American, I knew they weren't talking about me and folks like me, people of color, people presumed to have gotten here the wrong way. So I wanted to reclaim that term for all of us who are presumed not to be fully American. But the other reason I chose that term is because I am descended from a slave named Sylvie, who lived in Charleston in the late 1700s, and though the Constitution made her three-fifths of a person, she's my great-great-great-great-grandmother. And they didn't consider her human, but she was here, and she made me a real American.
You come from a political family yourself. Tell us about your family background.
Political, I don't know. My father was an appointee of President Jimmy Carter. My father was a physician, was Assistant Surgeon General in the Carter administration. My father's prominence in medicine, government, and academic medicine allowed us to live in communities where I was going to go to, you know, the better schools, quote unquote, and have access to educational opportunities myself. I am college educated. I have two graduate degrees. I myself am political. I was an Obama delegate representing my neck of the woods in the San Francisco Bay Area. Politics have been an important part of our life.
We're talking to Julie Lithcott-Hames, author of the new memoir, Real American, about growing up biracial in the United States. Your father is where you get your African-American heritage from. Your mother is British.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a picture of you as a little kid on the cover of your book, and you've got this big afro.
And a scowl that looks like Frederick Douglass. I think I look like Frederick Douglass in this photo. Angry. Yes, keep going. I'm sorry.
No, you nailed it. You write in the book about really being, you know, with your father being a person of such high socioeconomic status. You write about being the only person who looked like you in a lot of neighborhoods growing up, and that led to issues. Tell us about one.
Absolutely. I mean, these are the issues we refer to as microaggressions in today's lexicon. And I think in some ways my book, in collecting up the various microaggressions I chose to put in here, by no means everything I experienced, but I hope I've created a trail of breadcrumbs that leads to this conclusion that, whoa, in the aggregate, microaggressions really distort a person's sense of self and make one contort themselves to try never to be called that N-word again, as happened to me when I was in, you know, my all-white high school serving as a student council president. And on my 17th birthday, someone chose to write the N-word on my on my locker. And so
that strikes me as a macro aggression.
But I didn't tell anybody, Adam, because I was ashamed. I knew I was the only black person in my school. I sort of felt that I was already racism had burrowed so into my psyche that I felt that my job now is to pretend this never happened and to try never to try to be the black person that white people will never call the N-word. And so I spent the next 25 years performing in a way that I hoped would result in no more scrutiny or judgment or loathing or hatred coming from white folks. And I think the point of this book in the aggregate showing all these microaggressions in the life of someone who is middle and then upper middle class and highly educated is that racism is agnostic to class. Racism doesn't care that your daddy worked for President Carter. You know, in fact, plenty of racist folks get mad at us when they call us uppity when we have achieved to this level. And the stigma of racism and the pain and the self-loathing that I felt despite being outwardly successful is, I think, the point that I'm trying to communicate with this book. I'm someone you went to college with. I'm someone you may have gone to high school with. I might have worked in the same corporation as you. And these were the things that were happening to me that you didn't even realize were happening. When I say you, I mean, you know, the sort of generic white colleague.
We are talking to Julie Lithcott-Hames, author of the new memoir, Real American, about growing up biracial in the United States, about the microaggressions and perhaps some macroaggressions that one might suffer in that context. Julie is also well known as the author of How to Raise an Adult. This was a book, a treatise against helicopter parenting that she wrote in part in a response to her experience working as an undergraduate advisor at Stanford University, or rather as a dean of freshman and undergraduate advising at Stanford. And now she has turned her own writing to her own life. What sense, you're a parent yourself, Julie, what sense do you have about how your experience all those years ago is different from the experience of younger biracial people growing up in the United States today?
Sure. So I'm 50. My parents had me in 1967, which was the year the Supreme Court said the anti-miscegenation laws declaring black and white marriages illegal were unconstitutional. So I'm born the year of loving, and I'm part of a biracial, we didn't even call us biracial then. We were just mixed, mulatto, some more derogatory terms. Nowadays, you know, 50 years later, we've got a critical mass of mixed race people. We're so prevalent in America that, you know, Madison Avenue and the entire advertising agency is now depicting us in ads. So things have changed, is my point. But here's what's not different. Racism is still here. We are not post-racial. A kid who is black or brown in America gets the subtle or not so subtle message that they are less than. And the one lesson that I have tried to deploy from the painful learnings of my childhood, tried to deploy as a parent, is do not raise my children in predominantly white communities. Raise them where they will have peers of color and mentors of color who can say to them when the N-word comes their way, if it does, you know, or that nasty thing happens, who can say, you know what, I've been there, you'll be okay, here's how I survived it, you will too. We know racism isn't going away anytime soon, but what we desperately need is people who will listen to us and believe us, because we're often told the things that happened to us didn't happen, didn't matter, shouldn't make us feel badly, or we should get over it. And when we raise children in communities with people who get it, then their agency and their sense of self is not trampled upon by those experiences, but they can be strengthened by the benefit and wisdom of those who are on that same path with them.
That's Julie Lithcott-Hames. Her new memoir is called Real American. You might know her also as the best-selling author of How to Raise an Adult. She is in Atlanta tonight to talk more about her memoir and to sign copies, and she will be at the Margaret Mitchell House, 7 p.m. We have details on our website, gpbnews.org. Julie, thank you so much for making the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Adam. I'll be with Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, so come out to see her,
if not to see me.
She is the best. Yeah, thank you so much.
We'll talk to you. In due time, Cobb County will be home to a cafe that provides two pleasures: drinking coffee and getting acquainted with adoptable cats. Last year, Java Cats Cafe opened its doors in Atlanta's Grant Park neighborhood. Now it plans to expand to Marietta. GPB's Sean Powers visited the Atlanta location not long after it opened.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good, thanks. If you have any questions, let me know. Most of the cats here have
collars on that have their names on them. Blue is male, pink is female. Do you guys have cats at home?
Two.
Awesome. Okay, well, you're good to go. Just have fun.
My name is Rachel Whitmire, and I'm a cat lounge host here, and my job is to make sure the cats are interacting well with all of our guests and that they have enough food and water and a clean place to use a litter box, and then also to figure out what their favorite toys are. That is a meowing piano.
Meow, 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 meow.
He seems to like it.
Hello.
They're all so sweet. I just love cats.
I'm Tita Lovell. I'm a teacher. I'm wearing a black cat t-shirt. I'm a big cat nerd, so it's right up my alley. No pun intended. I think cats just have a personality, and what I like about them is that you have to get to know the cat to really understand the cat, you know. As opposed to a dog, like, you know a dog from the get-go. This dog is happy, and that's the dog. As opposed to, like, it's a person. You know, if you meet somebody new, you have to take time to get to know them, and cats are the same way.
This is Olivia. She's that's been adopted. Mama that's Mama Turnip. She is very unhappy.
Would you like a treat?
If only had a video right now. The cat's trying to crawl out the window.
My name is Britt Mayo. I do field operations, basically data collection for a technology company. Right now I'm seeing lots and lots of toys. This is, so people can visualize it, almost like a skate park except for cats. There are ramps and there are little jumper boards for the cats to go up the walls, kind of diagonally, one board to the next. It's kind of a cat's dream playscape.
I used to have a black cat. He liked my roommate more, so I gave him to my roommate. My name's Bridget Bott. It's really cool. It's a different experience. So I love cats and I love coffee. So it's cool for the two to be together.
And then once it's at a blood temperature, you dunk it to where it's nice and silent, and you're just heating the milk to that perfect temperature. My name is Chris Mason. I am the certified barista trainer here at Java Cats. My wife was the one that told me about this place. I was going to school and working at a burrito shop, and my wife came up to me and said, like, Chris, there's a place that's serving coffee and cats, and you're really good at coffee, and I want to pet cats, so you need to go apply there and get a job.
My name is Hayden Hilton, and I am the owner of Java Cats Cafe. I just hope, you know, in a year from now, we're still successful, still doing high number of adoptions, that we, you know, live beyond the hype. Right now, people are really excited about this new, different idea, but I want it to be a staple coffee shop in Atlanta, and just people come for the coffee, not necessarily always for the cats, or people come for the cats, not necessarily for the coffee, but just be a great coffee shop that, you know, is giving back to the community.
That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. Olivia, one of the cats that you heard there, ended up being adopted. Hooray. You can hang out at the Cat Cafe, too, but you need a reservation. For details on how to make one and for photos from the cafe, visit gpbnews.org. Just ahead, a panel of Southern novelists on writing about Southern identity. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Literature from the South has a distinct flavor, but try putting your finger on exactly what that flavor is, and you'll find definitions as nuanced as Southern identity itself. Here are a few thoughts that we collected from our most iconic writers.
Whenever I'm asked why Southern writers particularly have a penchant for writing about freaks, I say it is because we are still able to recognize one. To be able to recognize a freak, you have to have some conception of the whole man. And in the South, the general conception of a man is still, in the main, theological. Flannery O'Connor from her essay, Some Aspects of the Grotesque in Southern Fiction.
Even today, the South is quirky, quick to take offense, fanciful. It has an attitude, a frame of mind. It prefers the flowery to the plain, likes its own jokes, its own rhetoric. It can laugh at itself at home, but it is immediately riled at any snicker from outside. Eugene Walter, author of American Cooking, Southern Style.
In large measure, Black Southern writers owe their clarity of vision to parents who refuse to diminish themselves as human beings by succumbing to racism. Our parents seem to know that an extreme negative emotion held against other human beings for reasons they do not control can be blinding. Blindness about other human beings, especially for a writer, is equivalent to death. Alice Walker in her essay, The Black Writer and the Southern Experience.
We're going to spend the rest of today's show talking about the appeal of the South in the literary world. I talked about this back in 2015 with an all-star panel. Susan Rebecca White is the Atlanta-based author of many works, including the highly praised A Place at the Table. Tayari Jones grew up in Atlanta, and this year she was inducted into the Georgia Authors Hall of Fame by the University of Georgia. Her latest book is An American Marriage, on shelves next week. Jones often writes about the urban South, focusing on the lives of African Americans. American families. And from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, we spoke to Daniel Wallace, whose works include the critically acclaimed novel Big Fish. This conversation from 2015. Susan, let's start with you. Could you try to posit a definition of what Southernness has historically meant in literature?
Wow.
What do you think about when you think about Southern literature?
I'm glad you asked her that.
I know.
Well, she made the mistake of coming here in person.
For me, I don't think that I can give a general overview definition, but I think that for me, when I think of Southern literature, I think about trying to dig into your roots and dig into these problems that vex our nation, but that are rooted in the South. And I think that that provides fodder, will provide fodder for literature for a long time to come.
Tayari Jones, does that resonate with you?
I do agree that Southern literature definitely is grounded in place and a certain self-consciousness about roots. But I don't think that we've cornered the market on that. I mean, if you look at a lot of the New York writers, the Brooklyn writers, of a generation ago, they're all about trying to find their roots, too. So I think the thing about Southernness is that we are investigating our roots, but I think we cut off our investigation with the founding of the nation. Like, that kind of seems to be what it's the time to look at, I think, that makes a Southern search for roots different than some others.
Well, certainly when I think of Southern literature, I think of Southern Gothic literature, which is often dealing with civil rights era topics. That's certainly an examination of the South, though what you say makes me wonder if the question, what is Southern literature, is kind of Northeastern normative, which is not surprising considering where the publishing industry is concentrated, Daniel Wallace. I mean, we don't talk about the classic mid-Atlantic novel.
Well, exactly. I mean, Southern literature has been genrefied in a uncomfortable way, I think, for almost all Southern writers, because once you're given that designation, there, with it, it does bring this kind of the word "just" is always you always think that's going to be uttered next. I'm just a Southern writer.
Oh, it's minimizing. You mean
minimizing? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's such a big. Bunch of people out there writing literature that people call Southern. I don't think that anybody, I don't know anybody that's completely comfortable with the term.
That said, do you see Southernness in your own work?
Well, I'm 56, and I've lived in Birmingham, Alabama, Atlanta, and Chapel Hill for 54 of those years. So how could I not be a Southern writer? That's all I know.
Yeah, absolutely. Susan, what writers really get the South for you?
Well, you guys started with two great quotes by Alice Walker and then also by Flannery O'Connor. When I was first writing my first novel, I read all of Flannery O'Connor's letters, and then I also read the essays in Mystery and Manners, and I remembered there was one line where she was talking to writers from the South, and she said, none of y'all used any mannerisms, none of y'all used any accents. You've got this richness of material that you're ignoring. And I think to Teyari's point, it's not so much that the South is the only place to write about, but if you're from there, there is so much to dig into.
Yeah, Teyari, what do you like to dig into from the South?
If I can just backtrack a little
sure,
bit to this idea about being designated a Southern writer and how a lot of writers feel limited by this, I just want to say that for me as a Black Southerner, I often feel that I'm not invited to the Southern mm-hmm. party,
yeah.
that Southern has been branded as white and usually rural, and I'm a Black person from a big city of Atlanta, so I'm always trying to be included in Southern things. I was recently inducted mm-hmm. into the Fellowship of Southern Writers, and that had been a career-long dream because I felt like not having that designation had exiled me from my own tradition. So I think while some people are trying to break out of the box, other people are trying to break in.
Yeah, it's such a great point. I mean, we consider To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, that race plays a central role in that story, but it's fundamentally from a white perspective and about how white characters are interacting with race.
Yes, I agree. And I think that the Southern, I live in New York now, I live in Brooklyn, and I think because of the way that Southernness has been exported, that people act like I got to Brooklyn on the Underground Railroad. You know, they can't imagine that there is African American pleasure in a Southern life. Mm. And that's one of the things that I do like to write about. I don't think that we should write about Black characters in terms of them being crushed under the heel of Southern racism. You know, while that's completely real, we have lives, we have pleasure, we have families, and we have a deeply Southern tradition, and I am completely invested in recording that tradition.
Do people spot you as a Southerner in New York?
Oh, my God. You know, I never thought of myself as super Southern,
yeah.
except here people say, oh, my God, where are you from? All the time. And my landlady, she says, oh, every time you call me ma'am, it just tickles me. And I say to her, every time you say something just tickles you, I can tell that your grandmother is from Alabama.
But these regional distinctions are eroding because of mass media, because of other forces. And, you know, I wonder, Daniel Wallace, is the South such an idiosyncratic place anymore?
That's such an interesting idea because I think of myself growing up in a suburb of Birmingham, which was no farms, of course, in the area. The closest I got to a farm was watching Green Acres on television. And I watched a lot of television. And in fact, you know, for a long, long time, I tried to, and to some degree actually succeeded in changing the way I spoke so I sounded more like people on television. And I could have been raised in so many different aspects anywhere, because there would be, you know, I had a television in my bedroom, and I spent a lot of time watching television in my bedroom, and so that was a huge part of my upbringing, as it was. But clearly, there's no escaping this, you know, the environment that you're in, and things that you learn without even knowing it. So I definitely think that persists, and I don't see it going away completely for a really long time.
Do we think, all of you guys, is there still juice left in that Southern Gothic aesthetic that is applicable to contemporary Southern life, things that writers could still milk? Susan, you want to take that?
Sure. I find that there is. I think that one thing that I find myself wrestling with a lot in all three of my books is the question of religion and Christianity and kind of how the teachings sometimes bump up against the reality of how people live in the South, in particular with race and how whites perceive race in the South. And I wrestle with that a lot in my books, and I feel like that's more particularly Southern, that there is a more, you know, of course there are religious people throughout the United States, but I think that in the South there's more predominance of it, and that that, again, is rich material to wrestle with in writing.
Tari Jones, does that resonate with you?
You know, the thing that I think about in the modern experience is, for me at least, I write about families, but I write a lot about living in the shadows of the martyrs. You know, I'm from Atlanta. That's Martin Luther King's hometown. And my second novel, whenever the mother is disappointed with the children, she says to them, "That is not what Dr. King died for." You know, if you wear a short skirt, mother's like, "How are you wearing that? That is not what Dr. King died for." And I feel that this is a larger, like a ghost, a haunting of, for me at least, the modern Southern narrative. Is your life worthy of all the sacrifices that have been made so that you may have that life? And that is the darkness that I feel like I explore in my work.
So let's make some recommendations. It's summer. It's time to read books on the beach. Who is writing about the South now in interesting ways, ways that people should read, aside from the members of this esteemed panel, of course? Daniel Wallace, do you have a tip?
I was going to say, well, the book I'm reading now and loving is H is for Hawk, but I don't think that qualifies for the question that you asked, unless it takes place in Southern England.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Those yokels down in Southern England, yeah. That's a funny thing when you think about how the Brits, to them, Southern means the exact opposite thing. Southern is where the money is. Southern is where the political power is. Southern is where the sophistication is, because that's where London is, and the Northerners are the yokels. Okay, either of you have recommendations for a Southern writer that we should look at, Susan Rebecca White?
Well, this book isn't out yet, but I just read The Opposite of Everyone by Jocelyn Jackson. It's going to be coming out in about 6 months. It was excellent. It was fierce. It was tough. And she's a Southern writer who seemed to me to be really pushing her own sort of limits and her own kind of categories of what she normally writes about. So that was exciting to read for me.
Tayari, do you have a tip?
I just read Driving the King by Ravi Howard. It's about Nat King Cole had a performance in Montgomery, and the White Citizens Council, you know, busted it up, and people were hurt and arrested, and I think someone died. But the novel is about Nat King Cole's driver, who's also named Nat, who kind of went to jail for that, and when he gets out, he gets to drive around his childhood buddy, and who is Nat King Cole. And so I loved it. It was really an interesting look at that moment when the country was changing and the role of Nat King Cole as an ambassador and as a man. I loved it. It was called Driving the King.
That sounds great.
Well, I actually wanted to just occur to me that I wanted to tell you about by Kim Church. It's a novel called Byrd, B-Y-R-D. And is a lovely book. And it's everything to me that Southern literature can be and do in such a quiet, lovely way, in this beautiful sentence-by-sentence language. It's not a long book, but it just encapsulates this what it's like to grow up in North Carolina. I definitely think that that's something that everybody should read.
I realize it's a fraught topic, but is anybody going to be reading Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman?
Oh, I'm all over it. Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, me
no,
too.
No, I don't think I'm going to read it.
Why do you say that, Daniel?
Well, I just don't think it should be in the world at this point in time. I wish that it would have been a document as opposed to a novel. I know that it's something that's worth looking at and studying. But I feel like it's more of a document.
Yeah,
a
historical item. I tend to agree. Tayari Jones, last thought goes to you. We have 30 seconds. Just what does Harper Lee mean to you?
I feel like To Kill a Mockingbird, I loved it when I was a child. I've become more critical of it as an adult. But I feel that she really showed that a Southern girl's experience could be a universal experience. And that, I think, everyone talks about race, but what she did for gender, just to say that a girl's story is everyone's story, that is a contribution I'll always be grateful for.
Well, I'm grateful to you guys. We've been speaking with authors Tieri Jones, Daniel Wallace, and Susan Rebecca White. Thank you so much to all three of you. It's been an honor, and love your work.
Thank you so much.
We spoke to Wallace, Jones, and White in 2015. And that's it for our show today. But the conversation with you continues 24/7. Tell us, what contemporary author do you think really gets the South? Let's open it up to filmmakers and musicians, too. Nobody from days gone by, please. Let's talk about artists who are working now who capture the South in a way that really resonates with you. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. Or you can tweet us. Our handle is at OSTTalk. Or you can post to our Facebook page, On Second Thought. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.